Good evening, Lehigh Valley, and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Sally Hamlin, your host this evening, and I am really pleased to have back in the studio with me tonight someone who's been here before, but I think is going to give us a lot of information. But before I introduce my guest, Bill Kirk, founder and president of Weather Trends 360, there's a few things that I would like to just share with you so we're all in sort of the same frame of reference when we're talking to Bill. This past year, we've seen a wild range of weather events. Lots of rain, fires, late season starts, strange seasonal weather, hurricanes, earthquakes. And tonight, I'm hoping Bill will shed some light on that. And as I was doing research for the show tonight, I found an article or two that I would like to share with you. This one is from Clewiston, Florida. It was done in September, and I thought it was really sort of an interesting sort of reaction to what's going on. I quote, "Vicious hurricanes all in a row, one having swamped Houston and another about to buzz through Florida after ripping up the Caribbean. Wildfires bursting out all over the West after a season of scorching hot temperatures and years of dryness. And late Thursday night off the coast of Mexico, a monster of an earthquake. You could be forgiven for thinking apocalyptic
thoughts,
like the science fiction writer John Scalzi, who, surveying the charred and flooded and shaken landscape, declared that this sure as hell feels like the end of times or getting a few dress rehearsals right about now. Or the street corner preacher in Harlem overheard earlier this week ranting about Harvey, Irma, and Kim Jong-un, in no particular order. Or the tens of thousands who retweeted this image of golfers playing against a raging inferno of a wildfire in Oregon. And just last month, darkness descended on the land as the moon erased the sun. Everyone thought the eclipse was awesome, but now we're not so sure, for all the recent ruins seems deeply, darkly, not coincidental." So, Bill, welcome.
On that apocalyptic note.
Yes, thank you for correcting me. I have trouble with that one. Listeners, you've heard from Bill before, and as I've said, he's the founder and CEO of Weather Trends 360, and he has been sharing with us over time a lot of his insights to what's happening in the weather. So rather than have him give you his background, I'm going to sort of short-circuit a little bit because he's done it a few times. But there are a couple things that I think you may remember. He was raised in Hawaii in the mid-70s, and he was sort of inspired by a week-long 100-inch rain that happened, correct, Bill?
1 week, 100 inches, yep.
Yeah, and your mother had a store at the time. And
furniture business, yeah, and the walls were collapsing. And it was, when you're 6, 7 years old and 50-mile-an-hour winds for a week and 100 inches of rain for a week, you know, it's pretty epic.
I can't imagine. You look out the window and you can all you see is water.
Water, yeah. Well, Hawaii's used to it, but that was crazy water.
Yeah, well, then eventually you went on to go to Rutgers and study
meteorology,
weather, and then you became a part of the Army.
Air Force. Same thing.
I'm not reading correctly here, gang. Air Force, and I'm going to let Bill go on from there as to his career and how he really got to Weather Trends 360.
Well, again, so weather was a passion as a kid. Obviously, when we have something traumatic, if you ask most meteorologists, they'll say it was a traumatic childhood experience, a blizzard, a tornado, a hurricane, a 100-inch flood. So usually it's that kind of thing that gets kids started in meteorology. It's just a fascination. And so it triggered it for me. So, yeah, now did the Air Force thing for 4 years, Captain Kirk in the Air Force. So I've heard all your weather jokes and all your Captain Kirk jokes. But, you know, you go with it, you know. And so today we have Weather Trends for the past 16 years right here in Bethlehem and help Fortune 500 companies with year-ahead weather and how much product to buy, where to put it a year ahead everywhere in the world. And so we've got huge, you know, Fortune 500 clients and thousands of farmers all across the world. So it's a I say it's a fun gig. I can't complain.
Well, it was interesting. Just recently, I was reading in the paper an ad for a retail store that was advertising some winter gear. And, you know, as you are well aware, we've had some recently very warm weather. So I'm hoping they're one of your clients.
They missed the boat because August, at the end of August, September was the coldest in 40 years, right? So that's the thing of timing, right? If you knew that August, September was so cold, people bought a lot of stuff back in August, September. Now here in October, it's milder and we're not.
And we're still.
So timing's everything.
Getting on to summer. So, Bill, what the heck is happening? What's going on right now?
Well, you know, everyone wants to point to Harvey, and then we can talk about Harvey. So Harvey, what actually happened with Harvey, most hurricanes, as they recurve to the northeast, I'll show you a track here where they all just recurve northeast. That's just the physics of a hurricane, in the Atlantic at least. Harvey got stuck, okay? It got stuck actually because of an extremely cold, as we talked about, late August, September. It was the coldest in 40 years in the northeast, north central. It was really cold. It was a big high pressure blocking the northeast. So the Harvey couldn't make the turn.
Also couldn't move.
Had nowhere to go. So it got stuck over Houston. Now, again, the apocalyptic piece of Harvey is a little bit overdone. I can show you back to the 1935 when they had 54 feet of water in downtown Houston.
1935.
Yeah. This year only got to 39 feet. Part of the problem with Harvey, too, is just urban sprawl. As we know in Easton from the flood years, you know, 15 years back, is that when you put a lot of urbanization upstream from their natural flow of, you know, Houston obviously has flooding issues to begin with, but the natural flow was from the north to the center of Houston. So you put all this urban sprawl to the north where the water was usually would be absorbed in the ground, like they did in Forks Township versus Easton, same concept, you just created exacerbated the problem. So I say man created Harvey here. This is, you know, not climate change or, you know, anything like that. This is a man did a stupid thing again, and we tend to do that a lot. You know, Maria is not all – it's extraordinary in the sense that we have more people today, obviously, than we had 100 years ago that are in harm's way. So Maria hit Puerto Rico. There was a stronger hurricane in 1928 called the San Felipe Hurricane, Cat 5. There was a stronger one, Cat 4, than Harvey or Maria in 1899. So those had nothing to do with climate change. It's just that, again, you have more people impacted than you did 100 years ago and more people in harm's way. You know, so that's these are climate cycles, you know, and they do repeat. And everyone seems to forget that we just came out of a 165-year hurricane drought with no major landfalling hurricanes in the U.S., 165-year record of nothing. Now, that was broken with Harvey.
Right.
So, again, we had no major catastrophe. Insurance companies were loving life after, I think, Wilma in October of 2005, because there's been no major hurricane, no major disaster. Sandy, yeah, that wasn't a major hurricane. It was a Cat 1, but meeting the true definition. So, again, a lot of this is cyclic, and we can talk about that later.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned a couple like 1939 and in end of the 1890s. So I pulled a 100-year weather report or something because I was looking at, you know, what's going on this winter and what happened 100 years ago. And if it is indeed cyclical, as you were just saying, that we go in these cycles, then, you know, what possibly could be in store. And there was an excerpt from An Old-Fashioned Winter by Charles Brooks. And he said, the United States east of the Rockies this past winter, though, this is 1917, 1918, was remarkably cold. Some of the details can be explained, even though the reason for the occurrence can only be surmised. Variations in solar energy received by the Earth must have been basically responsible. And then there was another one that said that the winter in Louisville, Lexington, Bowling Green in December and January of 1917-1918 was the coldest ever with 49 inches of snow. And that was the snowiest December and January by more than a foot and a half. So, you know, should we be looking back 100 years to maybe understand what's going on? Is it that predictable in those kinds of cycles? Or
yeah, again, unfortunately, again, our weather data, really, the good data only goes back to about the late 1800s. If you're talking on a global scale of having real reliable. So National Weather Service, NOAA, World Meteorological Organizations typically have a data set starting from 1895. Now, we know a lot about stuff before then, you know, hurricanes going back to the 1600s and Columbus and, you know, that things. But interesting you bring up the solar cycle here. Yeah, back in 1917, we had three things going on that I say are the three most critical cycles controlling climate on this Earth. And that's what's called the sun, first off. Okay. So in 1917, you're correct, we were in about 100-plus-year minimum cycle. Sun goes through regular 11-year cycle, ups and downs, gets very active, gets very inactive, you know, but then it goes through long-term 100, 300,000-year type cycles. So that was the early 1900s. It was the end of the Little Ice Age. You had a very weak, inactive sun, but we had two climate cycles on Earth that were teaming up. It was called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation Cycle. It's a 30-year cycle where the Pacific Ocean simply gets hot and cold and hot and cold. It goes up and down every 30 years-ish. There's another cycle called Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation Cycle. It's the Atlantic Ocean, and it's a 20-plus year, some 50, 70 year, but it's a cycle as well of hot and cold, hot and cold. Well, in that particular, you know, the early 1900s, late 1800s, particularly the year you mentioned, 1916, 17, you had a cold Atlantic, you had a cold Pacific, and yet a weak sun. You line those three things up, which we're lining up right now as we speak, you tend to enter these colder
periods,
cycles like
because
that.
Because there's nothing to warm them up.
I always say cold oceans, cold earth. That's the bottom line. And then you throw in a sun. 1975 was a good example where you had a cold Atlantic, cold Pacific, very cold actually. And so 1970, as we all remember as kids, right, snows and blizzards, which we've had lately as well. But people remember that as being, and it was. It was the coldest decade of the last 125 years, post Little Ice Age period, late 1800s. So it was a cold decade in the 70s. And so the sun, unfortunately, though, was in a very increasing stage, warming stage. So we were lucky. If that had been a weak sun in the 70s, we could have had some seriously epic, you know, crop failures and all kinds of things could have happened. But the sun, unfortunately, was getting a very strong phase at that point. All that's reversing as we speak right now. So it's, shifting.
So when you're looking at doing your predicting, and I'm looking at a little bit of, in advance here, but so you're looking at those three cycles plus a whole lot of other things.
I say there's 21 other cycles as well that are, I'll argue that the PDO, AMO, Pacific and Atlantic is 70% of the world, right? I mean, so if you're not looking at those, how those cycles, El Niño, La Niña is one little tiny area in the equatorial Pacific, right? So that's outside of these big cycles.
Okay.
But you know how much El Niño, La Niña plays in our weather. So these are much more significant long-term predictors. El Niño, La Niñas go through, 3 years, so 3 years ago we had the mega El Niño. It was the second or some people argue it was the strongest back to the, the late 90s or the second strongest. But it has implications on our weather. You had the rains in California. They've had the wettest year in 100 plus years, here this past couple winters. So it does have an influence, obviously, but that's just a little tiny area of the Pacific. It's much smaller than the PDO or the AMO. It does play a role.
Wow. So what is there anything else besides the cycles? You're talking about, population density being a major impact too, affecting. Is there anything else going on that is, today that we didn't have years ago that is, everybody says climate change, but.
You can argue, even the EPA, NOAA sites will tell you man's contribution to the carbon cycle is 1%. There was an interesting study, a Yale study that basically asked people, what is the biggest greenhouse gas? And I'll argue greenhouse gas, this earth is not a greenhouse. A greenhouse implies that you have no Pacific Ocean, no Atlantic Ocean, right? There's no Atlantic Ocean in the greenhouse, right?
Yeah.
So they're ignoring water vapor. So the Yale study says, what are the biggest greenhouse gases? The first one you're probably going to hear is CO2, mm-hmm. methane, right? Those are the things you're going to hear. Not true. Water vapor. Water vapor is the biggest greenhouse gas by exponentially more than both of those trace gases.
Evaporation.
And so what happens in the climate cycle change models is they've ignored water vapor. And you can't, because think about it, every day, and we're jumping ahead, but 40,000 thunderstorms. So there's over 1 million thunderstorms a year across the earth. Those thunderstorms transport, it's water vapor, right? So their purpose is to transport heat from the surface to the high atmosphere and dissipate it. Okay, that's what it is. But in a greenhouse, in the models, they ignored water vapor. They ignore hurricanes. We get about 75 tropical systems, hurricanes, typhoons every year on average around the world. Mm-hmm. Hurricanes serve a very same purpose, right? They're transporting equatorial subtropical heat, wrap it up into these intense storms, and then transport it to the North Pole, toward the poles, or, less percentage toward the southern hemisphere. So that's, again, it's water vapor. It's completely ignored in all the IPCC climate models. It's why they all failed, completely dead wrong. 104 of them, 103 of them, they all failed, I think, in July of 2013. Because they're ignoring one of the most critical things is just how is water on this earth transporting heat away from us? It's just, again, another cycle that's being ignored or processed.
So that process of the water and the evaporation and the movement is really what keeps the Earth's temperature.
Yeah, the purpose of a hurricane, really, there's one purpose. It's sad that it's destructive. But, again, I can show you the slides, where there's tracks here. I'll, for Sally's benefit here in the office here. But you can see that all these tracks over the last 165 years, these are all the major hurricanes across the Caribbean. They come off Africa, Caribbean, right through Puerto Rico, East Coast. You are eventually going to hit, if you live anywhere in that area of the Southeast Atlantic or Southwest Atlantic, you're going to get hit eventually by a major hurricane. It might be 10 years, it might be 100 years. So it's just like earthquakes, right? We shouldn't be surprised by Mexico's earthquake or California's eventual big earthquake. It's happened hundreds or thousands of times before. It's going to happen again. The only difference this time, instead of, you know, the big San Francisco earthquake 100 plus years ago, is now you don't have 6 million people in the state of California, 43 million people in the state of California. So more people will be impacted and more infrastructure will be impacted. So the cost of the disaster certainly are bigger. There's no doubt that Maria in Puerto Rico is far more significant than the San Felipe 90 years ago. Mm-hmm. There's just more infrastructure. Of course, it's going to be more costly to fix. So that's the sad thing. I just keep saying we put too many people in harm's way. But again, hey, look, we like to live in California, right? And
we're going
to have these Napa fires that, again, ironically, the Napa fires were nothing to do with other than we just came out of the wettest year in California.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about.
So what happens is that you build all this underbrush. You know, so California goes through the typical wet winter season, usually wet-ish. You know, down in the San Joaquin Valley, they get 4 or 5 inches. You know, it's not like it's wet. But this year they got very wet in the northern part of California, record wet. All that vegetation is beautiful. California was very, very lush and green in March, April, May. And then they get to their hot, dry summer. Every year's hot, dry summer in California, period. It's a desert Mediterranean climate. They don't get rain in summertime. That all dries up, and then it's just a tinderbox for vegetation.
Oh, okay.
So ironically, the drought years, there's nothing to burn. Everything's dead and gone. You know, there's not much vegetation. Where this just has raw, you know, you think about your bushes that just completely are dead, right? It's just a tinderbox for things to get started.
Yeah, kindling to.
And this was actually, they think now, telephone poles that, you know, transformers that fell over and just.
And maybe
sparked and lit it up like a Roman candle. So it's sad when it happens in a populated area, but.
Wow. You know, because, you know, unfortunately, you know, when you're in a nice area like the Lehigh Valley, you know, you don't have a lot of these major weather events happen. So it's sometimes hard to understand. I'm thinking they've had a lot of rain there. They've had a lot of snow in California. How did this happen that all these fires? But your explanation certainly is very helpful.
Usually the wet years, the wet winters tend to be the bad fire seasons.
Isn't that interesting? Mm. Wow. Okay. We're going to talk more about, you know, the influences on weather and some of the trends and things that Bill and Weather Trends 360 covers. But I hope you're able to get a lot of the information and sort of let it settle, because we are so fortunate to have this expertise right here in the Lehigh Valley. And a little bit later on, we're going to talk about Bill's popularity and the fact that he's going all over the globe to speak about, you know, weather and what's going on. But we're going to be taking a short break, and we'll talk more after this break with Bill Kirk, president and founder of Weather Trends 360. This is Sally Halen for Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Sally Hanlon, your host this evening, talking with Bill Kirk, president and founder of Weather Trends 360. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about the trends and what's been happening and the history and the tracking and the fact that some of these things seem to happen periodically. And Bill, let's talk about some of the information that you're able to share with our listeners about historical events and what would have happened today. And
sadly, today, again, it's just a lot of everything is just media sensationalism to some extent and hype and scare, right? If I tell you the weather is going to be sunny in 72, no news, right? I mean, it's just not what you're going to talk about, right? But if there's a calamity coming, right, we all want to tune in. I mean, it's just like the Weather Channel. I mean, the sad thing about the Weather Channel is that their ratings go through the roof when there's a hurricane. When there's no weather, they plummet. You know, so that's why advertisers a lot of times don't like certain things like that, because it's not stable, right?
Has to be event related.
Right. So there's been buzz here lately that we've had 10 straight named hurricanes in a row, which ties a record from 1878, 1886, and 1893. There's nothing unusual that we've had 10 straight hurricanes named in a row. Normally you'd get a break. It'd be a little depression or a storm, but we've had 10 hurricanes named in a row. Well, that's happened 150, 160, 70 years ago. It just hasn't happened recently, right? So we think it's so unusual. In reality, it's not. And I always like folks this, you know, you go back and look at some of these, just read a history book instead of a science book. You know, history book, the great colonial hurricane of 1635, right, pre-America. It was the strongest hurricane to hit the Northeast. It would make Sandy look like a joke. Again, to think that Sandy is the worst that we're ever going to see in the Northeast is just not true. Okay. It's just a matter of time. Look at these tracks, right? We're eventually going to get a big, huge, you know, there's another one in 1938. There was a Cat 3 that hit Long Island, and that killed, I think, I want to say 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 people.
Oh, wow.
So that was 1938, right? So that was a Cat 3. The colonial hurricane, they believe, based on the damage, was a Cat 3 with Cat 5 wind gusts. So over 160 mile an hour winds. We didn't have anything close, 80 mile an hour winds with Sandy. So, you know, we can have a lot worse. The only problem, again, think about it, 400 years ago, New York City was, you know, horse and buggy, and there wasn't a lot of infrastructure. So today, that same 1906 or 1635 hurricane would be cataclysmic. It'd be a $1 trillion disaster if it happened today. It will happen. That's the problem, is it will happen because we are in an area. Northeast coast is a little bit blessed in the way our hurricanes recurve northeast, so they tend to miss us off the coast, and we never get into that right front quadrant is the most devastating. So if the hurricane's coming up the east coast, the right front usually is out to sea. So that's why we're usually spared by these. Sandy was different in that it made a left turn. Okay. So that put New York City in the right front of a hurricane. You know, so that's the most deadly area. Storm surge, winds, everything compounds in that right front. The left front, it's not that bad. I've been through a lot of left front hurricanes, you know, and it's just not as bad. You've got to be in the right front side. So in any event, there's a lot of things that could go seriously wrong for some of these, you know. Again, just the cost will be ginormous.
Well, and you were saying during the break that one of the most recent ones could have impacted the Lehigh Valley, that you were tracking it?
Well, so Irma, yeah, we were all kind of panicked with Irma because Irma, I believe it was Irma. Irma was, so it was Harvey, Irma, then Maria with Puerto Rico. Irma was projected, their models, computer models. So these are short-range computer models. They're physics. So I always say physics is like drop a little rock in a lake and predict that ring, a storm, you know? I mean, the only problem in meteorology is we have to drop in millions of drops, millions of little storms at the surface and aloft, upper air, and predict all those interactions. So that's what the short-range models were trying to predict with Maria and all these hurricanes is how does this big, huge rock, you know, impact all the other little rocks and storms around the world? In the case of Irma, the models were taking it right up the Chesapeake Bay, right through Washington, D.C., and literally right over Allentown. There were several runs that took a Cat 3 strength in Allentown. Literally, I have a screenshot of the model prediction. I mean, now that's – fortunately, that was 7, 8, 9 days, 7, even a week out, there was potential. If that model had been right, it would have made Sandy look like nothing for us. It would have been – we probably would have looked a lot like Puerto Rico to some extent. I mean, it would have been catastrophic because we don't have the infrastructure. You know, we're not built really
cement blocks.
Whereas in the tropics, they're usually, you know, particularly Bermuda. Bermuda builds out of cement, concrete.
That's what I had heard, yes.
So they can handle a Cat 3, no problem. The problem, but much better than, say, even the Caribbean can. It was pretty scary there for a week or so out with Maria or Irma.
I'm glad I didn't know that.
My wife did, and she was a nervous wreck.
That's really, okay. So you have been really pretty busy. So let's talk about Weather Trends 360 a little bit and what you've been seeing, how the business has been growing, and where it's taking you. You had said when I tried to schedule you for this interview that you've been traveling a lot doing speeches and presentations. And so what's been happening?
I'm still having fun. You know, I haven't been doing this now I've been doing it really since I was 5 years old, really, as a kid in Hawaii. But commercially, we've been doing it obviously for about 16 years now. We just did some PA Municipal Electric Association out at Penn State. We do a lot of Penn State events. We did a big ag show, some farmers here in Mukunji back in the late spring. Matter of fact, next week we're doing something with Lehigh Valley Business Network. I guess the 90 ideas in 90 minutes.
Okay, the Weidenhammer thing.
So
yeah. Okay.
We're going to talk about, you know, I get to talk for 5 minutes. So this at least we talk for an hour, I guess. Okay. So we do like to do a lot of those things. I actually did one last week with a bunch of seniors at the, this is always interesting, senior citizens. And I asked, I said, now, what's the age demographic here? And like, well, 60 to about 95. So I like to know my audience, but that was at the Fellowship Community Center. And so we talked a lot of climate change and, you know, stuff that they were interested. And the neat thing about that, I always say, we don't learn from our elders, right? I mean, you don't talk to these folks that have been through 100 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. They have a vast knowledge of things that happened. And then that's why I'm a weird animal in the sense that I'm left brain, right brain. I'm part science guy, but I like history as well. So if we would just learn, as scientists get too focused on my model says this and that's what my, no, let's go back and take a step back as a scientist. No, I don't care about the models. The model's wrong. So let's let's figure out why it's wrong. Let's make it better. Let's, right? You know, so if these climate models were wrong and they were all 103 were wrong, then we ought to get back to figuring out, that's the fun part about science, is figuring out, let's solve something. Let's really, one gentleman we just met this week was the, you know, CEO of AccuWeather. Met him in New York, Joel Meyer, Dr. Joel Myers. And we talked about that. If you think about meteorology versus climatology, I always, and I'm not, in fairness to my climatologist colleagues out there, meteorology was the harder degree at Rutgers, where I went. Okay. You know, climatology is a lot of statistics and cycles and things, you know, but meteorology is a lot of physics and math and 8 semesters of calculus. You know, your head blows off with, you know, the meteorology aspect. So we were talking about that. If you think about the advances in tornado warning, you know, I mean, 20, 30 years ago, people died, you know, from no notice of a tornado. Whereas now we're seeing tornadoes, the physics and the technology is, we can see a tornado in the cloud 30 minutes before it even touches down. So now you can give 30 minutes advance notice of a tornado. Hurricane forecasting is a lot better. We're not surprised by there was a storm, you know, even back in the 40s, pre-satellite, pre-radar, right, that exploded off the Gulf of Mississippi overnight. So everybody went to bed, right? TV stations shut off at 8 o'clock at night. Nobody knew that this Cat 1 minimal hurricane all of a sudden exploded to like almost a Cat 4.
Oh my goodness.
Overnight. And then it came in, killed thousands of people. You know, so those things don't happen anymore. So I say, Dr. Noel Myers agreed that, you know, in meteorology, we have made a lot of great strides technologically and, mm-hmm. you know, in the physics to make things better. Where, you know, climate science, I think we got to go back to the drawing board here on some of this stuff and figure out why did that not work, and not just say the science is settled. I don't believe the science is settled until, you know, if your model's 100% right and we know it's right, then okay, then we can settle it. But it's until it's proven, right? You have to prove that your model was correct. And when they're not correct, you got to get back to the science.
Okay, so help me understand the difference between the meteorologist and the climatologist.
The simple way is just the meteorologist has to predict something.
Okay.
Right? So I have to predict an outcome. You know, okay. Climatologist is more a function of, you know, this is the climate of the Lehigh Valley, you know, over the last 30 years or 100 years or, you know, if you go way back, right, it could be very different. You go back to the Little Ice Age, there was 2 miles of ice on top of Lehigh Valley.
Yeah.
Right? So 20,000 years ago, there was no climate here, right? We were ice cubes. So very different back then. But climate, unfortunately, is defined as a 30-year period. Well, that's a drop in the bucket, unfortunately. And so there's just too much made with, I met a bunch of emergency management folks here not too long ago that were preparing for an climate change action thing. I said, what on earth are you preparing for? You know, and this was back when we were having the heat waves and the droughts and whatnot. And, you know, so, well, heat wave, droughts, fires, you know, the deal of the day, right? That's what we were experiencing when they were meeting me. I said, mm-hmm. Well, climate cycle's about the flip-flop here. You might want to be thinking about snowier winters. And then you remember the 90s when we were all talking ski resorts were going to go out of business. And then all of a sudden, we had a lot of epic years here recently. And in fact, on a northern hemispheric level since 2007, I think 7 of the last 10 years have been the snowiest of the last 60 years on a northern hemispheric level.
Okay,
so
okay. Again,
we flip-flopped into a colder, wetter, stormier cycle, if you will, in Lehigh Valley. We've not had a drought. Last year we had a little drought, but that's been a blip in about a 15-year stretch now of no major droughts or wildfires or that, you know, heat wave, that kind of stuff in Lehigh Valley. So had the snow. So just trying to educate folks of what you should be, all the same stuff you would normally prepare for in Lehigh Valley. What do we get in Lehigh Valley? We get big snowstorms. We can get ice storms. We can occasionally get the wildfires, brush fires in the Poconos, but they're rare. Sinkholes, right? Mm-hmm. And I always say sinkholes will come after really wet years. We're going to hit our dry cycle probably another 10 years. Maybe 10 years we'll end back into a drought cycle here, 15 years. Then we want to worry about sinkholes. You know, you've flooded all the water crevices below the earth. When that starts to recede, water's just like dirt, right? Mm-hmm. It's keeping us from sinking. It's just got a lot of power, you know, weight, if you will. So when those leave the crevices, I wouldn't be shocked to see a lot of sinkhole issues 10 years from now. Not right now, but, you know, maybe in 10 years. So in any event, there's just, unfortunately, too much, you know, planning off of an unknown versus planning on the known that we already know. So we should prepare for a hurricane, right? There is, the models did hint that we could have had a Cat 3 here in Allentown. We should figure out how to prepare for that.
How to do that.
What do we do if that happens?
Yeah. So. Well, how do you explain then, Bill? Like, it seems like our seasons are out of whack. It seems like, you know, we had a cold beginning of the spring, and then we had the cold end of the summer, and then we had... What's going on there?
But I mean, think about it. Really, how weird is it if you know, people always say, I remember folks saying, you know, California, our seasons are getting much, much longer. You know, the freezes in the spring are later and the freezes in the fall are later. So those seasons were longer. Completely not true. If you went and looked at the data, you know, I mean, it was like, that's not true. You know, it was a perception that people had because they read a story or they heard of something on TV. But it really wasn't true. You know, now I'm not saying there's some areas that are having, certainly when you get into the metropolitan areas, the Phoenix of the world, Phoenix is very, very different than it was 100 years ago. So yes, Phoenix has gotten hotter. You can influence it with urban sprawl and, you know, heat island effects and whatnot. You can alter the environment a little bit. But, you know, some of that is just, again, I think we get too caught up in the sensationalism of, again, I can point back to more extreme, you know, more extreme summers where you actually had, you know, the years without a summer that were only 70, 80 years ago, right? I mean, you can go back and say, where did, you know, snow in New England every single month? You know, I mean, that was 70, 80 years ago. It wasn't that long ago, right? So you know, but again, you didn't have nonstop phone apps and news and Facebook and, you know, everything now is so... you know, sensationalized.
And immediate. I mean, you don't get any chance to go away from it.
I mean, again, we can go back, you know, we had here recently, we've had 2 years in a row, well, several years in a row where the fruits got wiped out with late freezes. You know,
right.
I have about 30 fruit trees in my yard and they all got wiped out right at the wrong time, right when the flowers were coming out, hard freeze in April and May. It really wasn't that unusual. The normal, again, 30-year, 60-year average of a freeze would be mid-May. So when we had one that happened in, you know, May 7th or 8th, it was maybe unusual in the sense that it hadn't happened in 5, 6, 7, 10 years, 20 years, right? So we have a perception that, oh, that was so unusual that it wiped out all the, I know the plum guy here in the Lehigh Valley, I think it was plums that he grew, lost his whole crop, you know. The guys out, apple guys out in McCungee lost a lot of their apple trees. Mm-hmm. Their crop, not the trees. But so again.
So just, everything is relative in the perception that we're going against is really just our own little history with all this blast of information
coming
in.
Good folks to talk to are farmers. I talked to a farmer the other day out at this senior thing. He's 100 years old, and the stuff he could tell you is just like, you know, he's been through it all, you know, many, many, many times, you know. So again, we, you know, when you talk about a 30-year time span, it's just a drop in the bucket. It's, you know, really go back and again, I say read a history book and you'll read some fascinating things that happened right here, Lehigh Valley, you know.
Yeah, well, with that one thing that you quoted about back in the 1630s or something, I never remembered hearing anything about that. That would have been a great...
Yeah, so again, great colonial hurricane, right?
Yeah.
I mean, again, if that happens, and it will happen, trust me, it might be another 100 years, could be 200, hopefully it never happens, but it will happen. It's happened in the past, why wouldn't it happen again?
Yeah. One of the things that I get tripped up on, and that is the understanding of these like 100-year cycles. So in my mind, if something happens once, like 100 years ago, then it can't really happen until 100 years later.
That's not the 100-year event. So 100-year event could, in theory, happen every year, right? I mean, again, it's a rare event, but it doesn't mean it's so. Easton floods were an example, right? We supposedly had 300-year floods. Back in the early 2000s, I think it was, you know, that now a lot of those were just different thing. And again, you can point back to, okay, yeah, maybe we created that with the whole, I used to, you know, obviously live in Easton years ago, but the whole, you took farmland in Forks Township and you put all these houses in there, right? So you created less permeable surfaces.
Correct.
And so you created a problem in part, you know. Now one of the years I think was an ice jam, you know, so it was actually a severe severe winter that actually caused it, you know. So it's not all just the rains. So again, but so we had 300-year floods in a row, supposedly in Easton. That's not true. It's just like trying to say that the California drought was a 10,000-year drought. Completely false. If you go to the NOAA precipitation site that shows California's rainfall, it's actually getting wetter in California. If you look at the last 125 years, California as a whole has actually been getting wetter, slightly on a trend chart, you know, so they've had more wet years. So that drought that happened, I mean, again, you go back, there was a worse drought, you know, 50 years ago, it was a worse drought, 80 year. The problem is, again, what did you have 100 years ago in California? You had 6 million people.
Right.
Today you have 43 million people. 600 years ago, you didn't have an agricultural infrastructure in California. Today it's the whole Center Valley of California, where everything, about everything we eat, you know, vegetables is grown in California. So where I grew up, initially born in California as a kid, it's a green, lush, not because it's getting rain. You know, Bakersfield, California, where it's grown, vegetables, only gets 4 inches of rain a year. It's irrigated, you know. So you put this huge, vast infrastructure of agriculture in a semi-arid desert environment. That's stupid. You know, you don't have the water infrastructure to do that.
Right.
Okay, so just so because it happens they have really great dirt, but no rain and great sunshine, it wasn't necessarily the smartest thing to do, you know. So, again, we've done something
to alter the natural
just
process
not
or
the normal place that you would, So, again, when you're going to have that many people sucking water out of what limited water resources you have, that's a man problem. That's not a climate problem. That's a man problem. Right?
Yeah, so, that we aren't paying attention to Mother Nature, huh? So. Wow. So you have been, as I've mentioned it before when you've been on the show, what you do here and what you predict is something that's so technology advanced that Silicon Valley has offered on a couple of occasions to bring you over to the California coast. And you've been able to withstand that. Have you had any recent invitations, or are they pretty much realized now that Weather Trends is a Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania business?
We've won a lot of awards. And again, mm-hmm. I always find it, I'm usually pretty humble, but we have won some really neat awards we won that Forbes award on your show many years ago, about 6-7 years ago. Forbes said we were fifth most promising out of 13,000 companies. And most of the companies that won it were, of course, Silicon Valley. Yet we're fifth. And there was nobody in the whole tri-state area, you know, that was even on the list. You just don't think of the Northeast as really the technology sector. And so when you're doing year-ahead weather, it is kind of a hip, cool thing. I think you showed our office was on the front page of the paper the other, the Lehigh Valley Business Network. So we had the coolest office because it looks like a Star Trek, spaceship with all our weather data. But no, we are different. And again, I do, there's a lot of stuff here, though. Lehigh Valley, I mean, again, there's a lot of companies that are, I remember our governor years ago was saying that, this should be the Silicon Valley of the East.
Right. We're actually a few hours ahead of the
yeah, so again, I think we have a lot to offer here. Amazon certainly embraced the area and all, and unfortunately these distribution centers, but it is kind of a very unique hub. All our big retail clients like this area because you're really within a day of, 150 million people.
Right. Most of the population.
Unfortunately, it means we got a lot of trucks, but we are kind of a hub.
Yeah, we are. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad that we have you sticking here with us in the Lehigh Valley. And listeners, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and we'll be talking with our guest, Bill Kirk, who is president and founder of Weather Trends 360, after this break. This is Sally Hanlon for Lehigh Valley Discourse.
For program support on WDIY, we thank ASAP Mailing of the Lehigh Valley, a locally owned and operated mailing and fulfillment company offering marketing and production solutions for your custom mail piece, taking your marketing project from idea to delivery, creating a program that meets your mailing, marketing, and fulfillment requirements. For more information, 484-285-0204 or asapmailing.com.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. This is Sally Hanlon, your host this evening, and I'm talking with Bill Kirk, who is president and founder of Weather Trends 360. And if you were listening just before the break, we were talking about all sorts of things happening with his company, their awareness. They're very well known. They've been around for 16 years in predicting weather. And one of the things, as I was researching this show, and Bill has talked about and what he's dedicated his career to, is long-range forecasting. And yet there are those that sort of poo-poo it and say that it's, it can't be done over, 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So, Bill, how do you go about doing that? Because you forecast the trend, it's not exactly the actual, but the trend a year in advance.
So again, as a meteorologist, which I am from Rutgers, you know, you're taught physics and, you know, chaos theory. And, you know, we talked about the drops in the ocean, right? I always say if you just drop one drop in and predict that ring, that's easy physics, easy meteorology. If it's just one storm, mm-hmm. we have millions try to predict all those interactions. If you're trying to use a physics-based model, the GFS, the Euro, the things you hear from, you know, your local TV guy here, right? Those are chaos models, right? They're going to break down. They're pretty good within 1 to 2, 3 days. They're a little less accurate 5 to 7 days, and then they're pretty weak, you know, week two.
Okay.
And they're changing 3-4 times a day because it's feeding all this data, upper-level data, ship data, airplane data, airport weather data. All the data goes in the model, and the model crunches it with these physics primitive equations to try to predict the outcomes, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. out, you know, 14 days in theory. That the rounding errors in that model explode. So what we do is, so let's just take March, for example. So everybody in February this past year, we had the record hot February. I was in right. shorts with my 2-year-old daughter. You know, we're loving life. And then, but we had our forecast was for a brutally cold, snowy March here locally in the Northeast. Almost every single weather company on February 23rd, 25th, 27th, we're saying for March. So now we're only a few days away from the beginning of March. We're saying 68 degrees above normal in March, hot. Even the headline in the Washington Post was a hot, dry March, little snow, no rain. It was kind of the headline of March for the Northeast. Well, what did we have? We like to look at statistics. Let's just start with statistics. So the statistics in the Northeast for March, last year, a year ago, we had one of the hottest Marches on record. So what we do is we like to look at all kinds of statistics. Literally, I say it's a trillion times a billion calculations. That's
wow.
61 with 103 zeros behind it, right? So there's a lot of statistics all over the world. So it's, you know, it's not as simple as what I'm about to describe. But anytime you've had a one standard deviation above average March, a couple years, you know, 2 years ago, really hot, basically, 91% of the time, what do you think's happened the next year?
It's cold.
Cold. Now, that's an easy one. That's a one up, one down.
Right.
But you got to be, these are the really hot marches. So they're like 27 cases over the last 125 years. So is the next, so that's 91% odds that this March, you could have done this a year ago, right? Anybody could have done this simple statistic. 91% odds it'd be a cold March this year because we met the rule last year. It was record hot. And a 94% chance that it'd be snowy. Same general statistical trend. So the odds were about 6% at best that these guys were going to be right. IBM Weather Company did the same thing, right? They were saying scorching hot, dry March. And we didn't. We had an 18-inch blizzard. We ended up northeast about 3 degrees below normal. Now, were we panicked? Yeah, we got a little nervous. We just came out of the hottest February in history. You know, we were like, yikes, you know, maybe March could be hot, you know, but, you know, and it flipped literally on a dime. Even the short range model in the first week of March, and it flipped, as we all remember, you know, pretty epically. So March was brutal, as you recall. So that's an easy statistic. So why would you buck those odds, right, that the history tells me it's going to be a cold, snowy March? And it was. Now, if we layered in some other climate cycles and other things, oceans, you know, you could fine tune that forecast even further to say, well, it's not only going to be cold, it's going to be really cold, or it's going to, you know, it's going to be cold, but or it's going to be this snowy. So that's how you can do it. This summer is another good example. A lot of folks are saying there's a back-ended, I just met with, you know, a client yesterday, that an energy company that bet the ranch on a really hot late July, August, because that's what everybody was saying. And we had an opposite. We had a hot June and a cold August was our
right.
forecast for here a year ahead. And we're nervous when everybody's saying something different. Trust me, I get nervous,
yeah.
you know, and occasionally, you know, fortunately, about 20% of the time, they'll be right and we'd be wrong. But in that case, but usually about 80% of the time, we're usually pretty right on that. It was the coldest August in 13 years, you know. So this energy company got hammered because they were betting on a hot, dry August and it didn't happen. Now, it happened last year, but it didn't happen this year. So that was another easy one, that this summer was going to be as cold as wet as it was. You know, I think we had it the wettest in, I don't know, 10 plus years. And it was, you know, I think the wettest in 19 years for the summer. So it was a pretty wet year.
Yeah.
So again, statistics, they're just what they are. The climate cycles, you layer those in there. And I always say we look at 24. And I always ask a climatologist to name three. most can't get past 10, 6, 7, 8, you know. So we got a lot of them that are unique that nobody really knows exist. So that's how we, you know. Different than traditional meteorology.
And how do you go about getting this and getting? I mean, obviously you have a really experienced staff, and you're taking in information from all over the world, correct?
Governments collect the data, right?
Okay.
So all Australian Met Office, the Japanese Met Office, U.S. National Weather Service, NOAA, you know, UK Met Office, right? So they're the ones collecting the airport data, all the data. They run the big, sophisticated short-range computer models that go out a week or two. So you rely on them for the short-range stuff and the data. Now, in the case of the U.S., the data is free. The rest of the world, the data is not free. So you got to pay to buy the historical data and some of the real-time data. So, yeah, we're collecting lots of data. Thank goodness for Amazon Web Services, because the data is staggering how much. Anytime you get into the world weather data, it's one of the biggest data sets you could possibly have, anybody, you know, in terms of credit card information and all that stuff. I mean, it gets on that kind of a scale.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it takes a government to run these computer models, because you're talking multi-billion dollar computer systems to run these, you know, short-range physics models, you know, so you need a lot of money to do that. So fortunately, we have Amazon. We're able to, you know, use thousands of their web servers, you know, and do it, you know, much more cheaply than buying all that. You know, it would be outrageous. Couldn't be able to do it. So again, the advancement of technology has actually helped us as a company, because otherwise we couldn't do what we do.
Yeah. And based on your website, I mean, and listeners, I've had his app and I've been on his website quite a few times as I looked at doing events in the future. I can go in and go and predict for anywhere in the world if I'm going to be traveling what the trend is going to be. I put in the country or the zip code or whatever, and it allows me to sort of get an idea of an overview of what the weather could be like.
Yeah, we make 14-day free. You know, a lot of companies, you know, they try to make their money with the 14-day because that's really what they have. For us,
right.
It's not our niche. I don't, you know, so we put it out there. So if you want, it's 32 million locations. So really, wherever you're going, you'll find Antarctica. I don't care if you're going someplace. It's hard to get there. You can't really get there, but
yeah.
but if you, could, you did get approval to go there, you could actually see it. So it's neat. It's got a little Google Map interface. So if you don't even know where you're going, you can actually just play with it. I do it all the time. I like to go to this spot on Greenland. It's, you know, it's 15,000 feet up on an ice cap. What's the weather there? Oh, it's minus 70 below zero right now with a 50 mile an hour wind. You know, a wind chill of 120 below zero. You know. So it's fun to, you know, just play with it. Yeah, that's all free.
Yeah.
Free stuff.
Well, and your website also has some other very interesting information in it. Like I picked up the blog and information.
Captain's log.
Yes. And if you missed that reference before, when he was in the Lehigh Valley business for cool offices, it was Captain Kirk's starship, I guess, or
Star Trek. Right.
Star Trek.
So our office does look so. We have the real replica Captain Kirk's chair from the 60s. So as a kid growing up in Hawaii. One of the things was weather and science that I got was Star Trek, right? Think about it. You had flip phones and phasers and lasers and all this technology that did not exist in the 60s.
No, it did not.
Right? So we have flip phones a long time ago. We have lasers. We have all this stuff that was in a kid's show, right? So now, again, I always say embrace it. You know, you could take the brunt of all the jokes or just go with it. So we went with it. So we have now our Star Trek office, you know, in addition to the chair, which is the old 60s chair. And what's neat, we put a green screen behind it, so you can actually sit in the chair, and I can take you wherever you want to go. So anytime anyone comes to our office, we make them sit in the chair. I was like, where do you want to go? Someone said, I want to go to Pluto. So we send them a video with them in Pluto. So it's just green screen technology, typical weather technology. But so it's people have gone to Fiji, Tahiti. We put one guy, a Lehigh Valley business guy, we put him in the middle of Hurricane Maria. We had a picture of scary. It was one of the most wicked images I've ever seen from Hurricane Eye, and it was a super close, high up resolution. It was just scary. Anyway, we put them right in the middle of that. The office part looks more like the more modern Star Trek. You know, it's high tech, you know, lots of computer monitors and blinking lights. In fact, I take my 2-year-old daughter in there, and she's just like a kid in a candy store. Like, you know, she dances and she gets so excited she can't hardly move, you know, because there's so many lights and buttons, you know, and I hit buttons and she's all excited. So, no, it's fun. Yeah, you know, we like to be if you're going to do something in life, you better have fun at it. So.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, your customer base. The 14-day free is really not your typical customer. You have a lot of major Fortune 500 companies whose product depends or their revenue depends on knowing the weather, correct?
Yeah, again, the Targets, the Kohl's, the AutoZones, the JP Morgans, the Zappos, you know, really any seasonal product you buy, we've looked at about 10,000 of them at this point. So beer, beverages, I'm drinking my iced tea here. It all has some weather influence. We've talked in the past about how every degree hotter it is. So right now, the hot October compared to the, let's say, August, iced tea sales are probably way up. Well, they are way up in October versus August. So in August, they were way down, you know, 20, 30%. Every degree hotter, there's about a 2, 3% increase in tea sales, iced tea sales or Coke sales or Pepsi sales or beer sales. Now, every degree colder, there's a downside of 2%. You know, so this summer, let's say, was 5, 6 degrees colder. You know, you're talking about a 10, 15% decrease in demand for iced tea, you know. Whereas now here in October, let's say we're 5, 6 degrees hotter than last year. Now the demand's up, you know, 15, 30%. So
in your model and when you're working with a client, you're not only analyzing and looking at the future weather patterns and trends, but you're looking at the impact of the weather on their business because they may not know. I mean, they may have a feel But they might not know that every 2 degrees or whatever.
We call it the power of 1 degree, right? So we try to educate everybody on that simple rule of thumb. And it's literally that simple. And we do standard regression, multivariate regression, all this typical analysis of weather and sales by store, by day or week, going back 3 years, 5 years, however much data they have. And it can be anything. We have analyzed all kinds of things. You know, your electric bill can be analyzed, you know. And so, you know, this winter, for example, we'll talk about that, but your electric bill's going way up. Your consumption's going up, in addition to the taxes, I guess, they're going up too. But so, yeah, it's just predicting the volumes. And then week by week, store by store, out a year, then they can plan marketing and advertising. And, you know, so if ever, I would say, if there's local store, big store, AutoZones, Home Depot, you know, the Targets of the world, if they're out of stock of something, you could probably blame us in part because they didn't plan appropriately.
Interesting.
This could be one of those years where they didn't plan appropriately. If they're planning off the last two winters, they've not planned appropriately. They'll be shocked.
So, what's in store for this winter from your perspective?
Well, so, again, I like to go with statistics. You know, so we've had two extremely statistically very unusual winters in the sense that they were very warm. So we had 2 years ago, it was very warm. This past winter was a dichotomy of an extremely cold December and then a really record hot February and then a cold March. So this winter was actually colder than winter 2 years ago, which was just hot and dry throughout. And we had the one blizzard, right? All the snow came in a 35-inch blizzard in January. You know, that was the freak of winter, right? There was nothing else.
Yeah.
This year is very different. You know, you can look at statistically, but more importantly, I talked about some of these cycles, you know, PDO, AMO, NAO, I mean, all these cycles. So I'm just going to grab them off real quick. But this is what a lot of the short range guys like to look at when they're making the thing. Our statistical forecast was done a year ago. So we already had our winter forecast now for pretty much a year. So we look at things like the solar flux. I told about the sun. Mm-hmm. The sun has just dropped exponentially. We're in a 100-year minimum right now, but we're about to be in maybe a 300-year minimum. So that's going back a little ice age time frame, 16, 17, 1800s. The sun is just kind of dimmed.
Okay.
It's just the energy
minimum
output.
Power.
Yeah. So it's I don't want to say it's a normal cycle because it's very unusual to do this. It's a 100 to 300-year event. And that'll happen for, we don't know. It'll happen for the next 11 years. It could happen in the case of the little ice age, it happened for 200, 300 years. You know, so solar physicists are kind of concerned about that because it is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not the norm. So that's one thing. Is less sun, you're just going to get colder and snowier in the winter months. You know, that's just common. AMO is down. The PDO is way colder than it was. The QBO is much more negative than it was.
Okay, what's QBO?
These are just isolation cycles.
Okay.
Now, another one folks like to look at is Siberia. This is an easy one to do because you can do it right now. Siberia snow cover is up about 27%. So what happens with Siberia is, so it's already snowing. You look at Siberia snow in the fall, so September, October, is they build up a snowpack. That's where the Arctic air is coming from, Siberia, right? It's going to come over the pole and right down to the U.S. So that's what we're looking at. We see that. So that's another cycle. So in any event, there's just a lot of things. La Nina, we're headed for probably last year where the oceans were kind of increasing temperatures. This year, they're all plummeting. They're getting colder right as we speak. So we're headed for a moderate to maybe strong La Nina, for sure a moderate La Nina by January, February. Those are not good if you don't like cold and snow in the east.
Well, and I was surprised to hear that it had already started snowing out in the west.
My mom and sister were just out there in Yellowstone, and they had they were out there the last day of summer, and they had a 1 to 2 inch blizzard the last day of summer in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
So they've had three now. They've had three out there. That pattern actually kind of flip flops to some extent. I mean, it's a sign of things to come, but that kind of shifts more northeast as we get into the core of the Siberia snowpack. So again, it's nice. Siberia snowpack's increasing rapidly. You know, you could argue the Western Canada, but eventually that flip-flops to the East Coast as we get into the winter months, you know, November, December.
Wow. Well, okay. So I'm going to make sure my winter jacket is all ready to go.
And we're saying about 37 to 50 inches, you know, snow, and a lot more frequency and below normal.
And is it going to be occurring during the normal months of winter, or are we going to see something?
Even in March. We have another cold March. March is, again, I told you about the March statistics when it's really hot. Next year, it's very common to have a couple, two or three cold Marches in a row in the Northeast. So once you've had a really cold March, it's very common statistically. It's only maybe about 80%, but then the next March is actually cold again. So if you didn't like this March, you're probably not going to like this coming March either.
All right. Now, you're like warped age from where we were in predicting the weather, even just a few years ago. But are there changes happening in your field now? Are you seeing other things coming up as far as weather prediction that will even advance it further, add more to your formulas or?
Not for, again, we know how to make what we do even way more accurate. The problem is just the computing power. That's always been the problem in weather. We had the weathers that equations that could predict the weather, like even back in the 20s and 30s. There was a study back in the 30s where they put 100, you know, statisticians in a room, ran all these physics weather equations to make a one-day forecast. The only problem is it took these 100 people with no computers. It took them 2 months to do it.
For one day.
The forecast was right, but it was already 60 days past because they didn't have the computing power. So that's always the limiting factor, is just the computing power. There's just so much data. So that's the problem to some extent, right? You're always right, you know. Never get enough computing power, you know, to do what you want to do, you know. So you're always like waiting for the technology and that capacity to catch up. But, unfortunately, one of the pet peeves is just that why there's no more, everyone's so focusing on make the 1 to 3 day forecast better. And they're all splitting hairs. I laughed at this study that just came out, you know, IBM did a study that they're the most accurate, you know, and, you know, okay, so they're 74% accurate on a day 1 to 3 forecast. And AccuWeather is whatever, 75% accurate, you know. It's like, who cares? You know, it's like you're splitting hairs here, you know. It's just, yeah. You know, there's no real focus on what we do with the year. I argue that if we could have really accurate 3 month ahead or, you know, 6 month ahead, think about all the things you could do from a humanitarian perspective that you could really say, we've got a huge, like, okay, so we think there's a huge problem. We think we're actually going to enter into a hurricane cycle here that is probably more conducive, at least next year, maybe. Where, you know, you could have another active year, you know. So if you can really refine
start
that technology,
that,
we can start to say that, you know what, we got a huge problem here that's starting to kick up again. You know, we had this still 12-year drought of no major hurricanes, and now we're entering maybe an active cycle for a couple of years.
You had mentioned you had gone to New York and met with a gentleman who's in charge of AccuWeather. Is there any kind of conference that you guys all get together and discuss this stuff?
There is. Unfortunately, it's too politicized.
Is it?
There's agencies that have it, but he's not a fan either of some of this stuff, but Barry Myers was just nominated by, I think, the president for the head post of the National Weather Service. So it'll be interesting to take a commercial business guy of 60 years and making him the head of the governmental weather service.
Oh, boy.
We'll see. Yeah,
we'll see
how
happens.
That works.
Well, we're going to be wrapping it up in a minute or so. Bill, is there anything you want to share with our listeners before we say enjoy your winter season that's coming up and embrace with your winter clothes and mittens?
Yeah, no, cold. Like I said, 37 to 50. The 2 years that line up statistically and cycle-wise is 2010, we had 2 below normal and 39 inches of snow. In 2013, we had 3 below normal and 68 inches of snow. So, yeah, I don't know. Get ready.
Get ready. All right. All right. You heard it here first, listeners on WDIY. Bill, thanks so much. I am really glad that you were able to get your schedule so that you could be a part of WDIY and Lehigh Valley Discourse again this year. And listeners, again, Bill is the president and founder of Weather Trends 360. And if you haven't had a chance to look at his website, weathertrends360.com is the website. And he has a blog that he does, his Stardate blog, periodically. And it has a lot of good information, especially if you're really into weather.
Yeah, so it's right on the front page. Our dashboard gives you the hour by hour, the week ahead, the cool 2 interactive maps, and then this log we do at least once or twice a week. So it gets all the current stuff going on. So that's a one-stop shop for weather.
Okay, Bill. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I would like to thank my guest, Bill Kirk, president and founder of Weather Trends 360, for taking the time to share his perspective of the weather. This is Sally Hanlon for Lehigh Valley Discourse.